So, for today's sutta class, we have the sutta on emptiness. There's nothing there, the Sunyata Sutta. So, I suppose, Ali, does anyone know how to use this thing? So, just wait for a few moments until. So, first of all, what day is it today? So, you've still got a long time before this retreat ends. How many of you have already started packing your bags? So, unpack them afterwards. Don't pack the bags until the very last half an hour. Otherwise, you just, you pack your bags, get ready, and a couple of days before coming here, and a couple of days before leaving. And just, where does the retreat go? We're always too far in the future. And who knows? Maybe there is the Perth airport closes down. Maybe there's an earthquake. Maybe there is something which you can't fly anymore. Well, isn't that wonderful? You'll be stuck here in Jhana Grove for the rest of your life. So anyway, just make the best use of our time. We spend so much time in the future just waiting for something to happen. And that way that we waste most of our life. Wishing days and weeks of our life away. When the disease disappears, when I finish the project, just when everything gets well, then I'll be happy. Not realizing that happiness is always right now. So, we're just ad-libbing until we can. We're just talking at us in the interviews about the future. And planning for the future. And I was reminded of an aircraft story that this was the story which was told to me by the person involved up in the dining room of Bodhinyana Monastery. He was an Australian man. He was doing business in Mumbai in India. And when his business had finished, he ordered the taxi from his hotel to take him to the airport in plenty of time. But you know that taxi drivers in some countries, they are poor people who come to the city from the countryside. So that was the case with his taxi driver. The taxi driver of all destinations did not know the way to the airport. He was from the countryside. And so they came to the airport, no trouble. And got totally lost. At which point, the gentleman, the businessman, got very, very concerned as he was wandering all over Mumbai and not getting anywhere nearer to the airport. But when they finally did get close to the airport, it was almost time the plane was going to depart. But in those days, the planes, the aircraft in India were always notoriously delayed. So he thought he still had a very good chance of catching his flight if the flight was to be delayed. But he saw through the window of the taxi his flight, I think it was KLM, his flight take off. He'd missed his flight. And for those of you who have connections, you have to go from one place to another place to another place. It was so messy. You have to ring people and change appointments. And he was so angry at the taxi driver. You stupid taxi driver. You stupid man of all places. You should know the way to get to the airport. That's the most common destination. You made me lose my flight. You've caused so much trouble. He was very angry at the taxi driver. But as he was getting angry at the taxi driver, through the window of the taxi, he saw the plane which he should have been on come crashing to the ground. It was one of the great disasters in India at the time. And he said, if I'd have been on that flight, I would be dead. You wonderful taxi driver. I love you. Have $100. Have $200. You saved my life. And he's angered to such gratitude. And he told me that story up in Bodhinyana many years ago. And he just, what a wonderful experience that was. Changed his life. We always think that, oh my goodness, what would happen if we miss our flight? Always planning for the future, but you don't know what will happen in the future. Who knows? And so what happens is, if the future does change to a good way, it means that, whatever happens, we can always make something of it. Ah, great. We've got the... What's that? The laptop's on its way. Okay. So again, you can't plan the future. This is all about the summary of the Satipatthana and Nibbana through Anapanasati. And part of the practice for a good Buddhist is always to be patient, not to rush, to live in the present moment. If the laptop had come on time, then of course I would not be able to sort of give that little talk about not expecting things. And just how life turns in such very amazing ways. There was another story of a gentleman who sometimes go and stay with him in Jakarta. He's one of Handaka's friends, not Handaka. And he was telling me that he had one of these, what you would call the boss from hell. Now if you think you've got a tough boss, listen to this story. You know, he was doing a really, really good job, really working hard, and that one day he had a young family, a mortgage on a small house, and the boss called him into the room, into the office, and said, I want you to resign. He said, what for? I'm doing a good job. He said, here's the paper, sign your resignation. Why? And the boss took out a gun, a loaded revolver, from the drawer and said, sign the paper or I'll shoot you. I don't know if they teach that in business school in Harvard or in Singapore. That was just really tough. And of course, you know, he didn't know whether that boss would do it or not, who knows. But anyway, so he signed his resignation. And he went back home, he'd lost his job, you know, for no reason except that, you know, point a gun at him. And he was, what will I do next? Because he had a young family, two kids, and a house to pay off. Where can he get a job now? And he was depressed for a couple of weeks, he told me. But then he thought, well, you know, I know a lot about the business, and I've got no moral gratitude to that boss. Why don't I use all my contacts and start a business in opposition to that boss? Which he did. And was highly successful. Became a millionaire. And his kids, they've done really, really well. And he said if he hadn't been sacked, forced to be sacked, he said he would still be working for somebody else, just nowhere near as successful. So, in a sense, he's grateful for the boss and his loaded revolver. All your plans. You don't know how life is going to turn out. That's why that plans are. Just don't make too many of them. And any plans you do make, make sure they're made out of rubber. So you can bend them, almost bend them into a U and just round and round. So you can adapt to the varying situations, circumstances of time. Okay, so now we're ready. And Nibbana Svanapanasati? Very good. So, Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. So now we have the Nibbana through Anapanasati. So, when mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati, is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. When the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, enlightenment. So that's just the introduction, just saying Anapanasati. If you practice Anapanasati, you complete Satipatthana. So why is it just, you know, that people sometimes think that Anapanasati is one thing and Satipatthana is another? They're the same. So if you just do Anapanasati, you do all of that, by Anapanasati, it already is doing Satipatthana at the same time. So, the explanation in detail. And how does mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, complete the four focuses of mindfulness? 1. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, and you are aware that they are long, when the in-breath and out-breath are short, and you're aware they are short, when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. Because in and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body, in the category of bodies. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. So, first of all, you can see just the way that that was condensed. They usually say breathing in a short breath, you know you breathe in a short breath, breathing in out a short breath, you know you're breathing in a short breath. Breathing in a long breath, you know you're breathing in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, you know you're there's too many breathings in and out. Basically, it gets very complicated. So you never do the word-for-word translation. How would you say that in English? When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. In-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. It doesn't mean you have to do one and then the other. Because I mentioned early on in this retreat, sometimes my breath is not long, it's not short, it's sort of average. So what am I going to do then? I'm not doing Anapanasati, it doesn't fit in. Well, what it really means is you're sort of aware when you're breathing in and breathing out, it's a longish breath or an average breath or shortish or short to middle. So you just understand the length of the breath roughly. So it doesn't have to be, you have to do short and then long before you can go on to the next one. But then you learn to experience the whole of the breath. And you've heard me teach that from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. So, see my finger. This is, okay, I've got to change it because you're seeing it. Moving to the left and then to the right. Left, the right. Left, right, like in, out. In, out. So you can see that, that's not that mindful. As you get more mindful, it's moving to the left, you can see it moving all the time, right to the end. Then it moves to the right. All the time, that's the complete awareness. Are you hypnotized yet? No, I don't want the jokes. So, you're watching the whole of the breath. And then as you watch the whole of the breath, Is that something you decide to do? It is, you don't have to decide to do it. It happens naturally. You're aware of the breathing. And then as you focus in more, you get more aware of the breath. Just like the walking meditation. You know, you're moving left and right. And after a while, you see the whole of the feet moving, just from the very beginning to the very end. Your mindfulness becomes continuous, uninterrupted. And you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. How do you calm the breath as you breathe in and out? I mean, all of you, most of you have been watching the breath and it gets very peaceful, it gets calm. It happens naturally. Why? It's because you're not doing very much. You don't need so much oxygen. So you don't need to breathe in so much. It gets calm all by itself. So you're focusing on the breath and it gets very peaceful and calm. Now sometimes, I don't know for those of you who've been to many retreats, sometimes there's this silly argument about, oh, but that third stage, you learn to experience the whole of the body as you breathe in and out. Sabbakaya, Patisangwedi. And come on, you don't, when you're breathing in, you're watching the breath go in, go out, you don't become aware of the toes and the knees and your left ear when you're breathing in and out. The body, in this particular case, means the breath. Now you've got the word kaya, but that means so many things, and it says specifically down here, because the Buddha regards the breath as one of the bodies. It means a body. So it may be difficult for those who don't know Sanskrit or Pali, but watching the whole of the breath is what is watching the whole of the body here. So it's calming down the breath. And that's the first, so the Buddha says, that qualifies as the first Satipatthana. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn, I forgot actually the fourth one, the calm the breath, they call that the Kaya Sankara. You calm that breath. Because it's, the body is just, while the breath is formed by the body. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience the mental formation, the citta sankhara, piti sukha as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm this citta sankhara, mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of experience, the Vedana, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. For being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. And first of all, you can see that this is where you get to what we've called the delightful breath. The meditation is happy. You are supposed, expected. You are asked by the Buddha, no less, to experience joy and pleasure as you breathe in. And again, you don't watch the breath as much as you're watching the joy and the pleasure, the delight of breathing in and being calm. And that is something which, again, you can't force, it just happens. Why? Because you experience the mental formation, it's a citta sankhara. This is the way the mind experiences the breathing when it gets calm. It's, as I often say, people have kept reminding me of this now, the first baked bean which I tasted after the retreat I did a couple of years ago, last year, I think it was. But it's amazing, just, that's not in the baked bean. It's just the way the mind looks at the baked bean. It's a citta sankhara. It's just what the mind is adding on to that little bean. So you see here that this is where the breath starts to look delightful. And it counts as an experience. It's a vain love. It's just the quality of the experience. Sometimes it's pleasurable, sometimes it's not so pleasurable, sometimes it's in between. But in particular, this is the experience, the second satipatthana. You're focusing on the joy. And also, on the happiness, you understand where this comes from. Breath being delightful is how you perceive it, how the mind perceives it. And you calm this mental formation of piti sukha, it becomes soft and wonderful. And being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. It's the second satipatthana. In the first satipatthana, you're more aware of like a bodily sensation. The fifth sense. The fifth sense of physical touch. Here, it's more like the mind, how the mind interprets the breath. Through the sixth sense. So you're adding a little bit extra understanding of where the mind works. The body is one thing, but the mind is something else. Have you ever heard that simile of the two arrows? The physical arrow and the mental arrow. When we have pain or suffering. And so the physical arrow, you can't do too much about that. That's having a body, it aches. The mental way, the way you react to it, is a lot different. And you have a lot of opportunity there. So physical suffering, but hardly any mental suffering. And that's 99% of the pain, or 95%, is one's mental reaction to it. It's going to hurt. The doctor comes and said, well, this is an injection, but it's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt. Don't ever do that and say that. Because if you do, then it really does hurt. Sometimes, I don't know, out of compassion, we don't have to lie, but you just, okay, here we go, and just banging the needle before they know what's happening. And then sometimes we'll just say, oh, this is easy, or whatever, and then they don't hurt so much. So anyway, that is the idea of the second part here, the mindfulness experience, which is the Anapanasati 5, 6, 7, 8. This is where you're really watching experience and how you interpret experience. And just how, and so many times, sometimes people like one thing and you hate it, and other people hate it and you like it. Why? So you can see this is the mental formation. You understand what experience is and its causes. So that's, the Anapanasati is fulfilling the second part of, second four stages of Anapanasati. And now we get the next four stages of Anapanasati, which is number 9, 10, 11, and 12. When you learn to experience the citta, citta pati samvedi, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to brighten the mind, sampasadanang, chittang, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to settle the citta, samadahang chittang. And when you learn to enter jhana, vimochayang chittang, as you breathe in and out. Are you impressed that I know the Pali of this? It's good to know the Pali because you understand what the meanings are. The citta, what is it? You've been watching the breathing and then you watch the beauty, the delightful, and then this citta, what the heck is that? And all that's really happening is because the breath is calming down and all the other parts of the body are starting to disappear or have disappeared, then all you're left with is the mind. And the first part of the thing you see with the mind is usually just a nimitta, beautiful light, or very intense peace and pleasure sometimes. If you're, instead of a visual person, a feely-feely person. But, this is natural. There are some times when people can experience that light, or sometimes a delightful breath, and they're still thinking, or they can still feel the body, or they can still hear sounds. But it should be like, it's not so much disturbing. If it sounds, it's like 100 miles away. It's not 100 miles away, but that's what it feels like. of his body. The body is pretty comfortable, but you can still sort of feel it. And if it's thought, it's like background noise. It doesn't really catch you. And if you want to know how to deal with those experiences, it's like the lotus is opening up, but it hasn't fully opened up. So you can still see the layer of petals before, but you can also see the layer of petals inside as well, the next layer. And it's just deciding whether to fully open, so you can only see to see the inner layer of petals, or it's going to close up again, and the inner layer of petals disappears. And maybe the delightful breath and the nimitta. The nimitta is sort of opening up, but the delightful breath is still there. Way to deal with that is a simile which I learnt going on aircraft. Sometimes you can get insights in so many different places. And so when I was travelling on the aircraft, and you had no choice but to watch the in-flight safety demonstration. Even though you've heard this many times before, every aircraft is different. Your safety is our priority. Sometimes you know that so well you can just, you know, do it yourself if the video fails, so I can get up on the island. But one thing I did notice looking at that was that when I first looked at the seat in front of me, you could see the upholstery of the seat in front of you. You could see the plastic border of the little TV screen. And then you could see just the video which was in the screen. But then, as naturally, without forcing it, my mind started to go inside the screen and fit inside the screen perfectly. The upholstery on the seat fell off the radar. The plastic boundary of the edge of the screen, that fell off the boundary as you zoomed in. Again, just like the old Google Earth, as you zoom in, what's on the edge just fades away, and you sort of zoom in, and that's all you have left. What I really noticed, if it's like one of those small little screens on economy class, it's only small, but you fit into the screen. There's that huge, big crystal LCD, whatever it's called, screens. Huge, but still, your mind just fits in, just to the border. You know, it doesn't really matter whether you watch a movie on a iPhone with a very small screen, or on these huge, you know, many foot wide screens at home. I often say the only time you know how big the screen is when it's not turned on. Because when it's turned on, your mind actually fits perfectly into the screen. And everything else falls off the edge. Well, I like that idea of focusing, of zooming in. So that if you have, say, a delightful breath and a little nimitta is just coming up, sometimes, if it is the right time, you can hear some sounds and thought, but keep the sounds and the thoughts on the edge of the screen. Don't bring them into the center. If you keep them on the edge of the screen, it's only a matter of time before your mind zooms in and the thoughts and the feelings of the body fall off the screen. Now that is particularly important, you know, when sometimes you get some meditation, it gets quite sort of deep, and your heart starts pumping, excitement or fear, boom, 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 boom. And what's happening there is, you know, it's just nature. You get sort of excited, afraid. That's what the heart does. Adrenaline starts pumping in. But how do you deal with that? If you focus on the heart and say, calm down, heart, slow down, the heart gets more of a problem. And if you really try and hold the heart so it doesn't beat at all, then you are in even bigger problem. So what we do is, yeah, you can feel the heartbeat, but don't put it on the center of the screen. Keep the center of the screen maybe on your breath or the delightful breath or even maybe a nimitta. Keep that on the center. You don't try and get rid of the breath. You don't try and get rid of the heartbeat. If you try and get rid of it, it's giving importance. It means you bring it into the center of your screen. Leave it just on the edge. Yeah, you can feel the body, but it's over here somewhere. And your delightful breath is right in the middle. Or, you know, the nimitta is in the middle. You can sort of experience some things on the edges. But keep the main object in the middle. And soon everything else falls off the edge of the screen. Your body's gone. But don't check, oh, has my body disappeared now? As soon as you check, it comes back again. Don't check, is the sound gone? Otherwise, the sound comes back again. Just zoom in on whatever's in the center of your mind, your center of your screen. And then sounds and feelings in the body, they tend to just disappear. That's what I would do with those story of the mosquitoes in Thailand. You zoom in on your breath and you couldn't feel your body. It was just over there somewhere, and then it just fell off the screen as you zoomed in on the breath. So you couldn't feel any mosquitoes. Sound, you do the same. You just go in to say your breath, especially if it's a delightful breath, it's really easy. No nimitta, it's no problem at all. And you just zoom in on a nimitta. Maybe you can hear some sounds, but then after a while, you're zooming in, and that's all you can experience. And the sounds have gone a long way away. Zooming in, focusing. You don't do that. You just make sure you don't take the problem and bring that to the center of your screen. Then it happens. So you learn to experience the nimitta as you breathe in and out. You don't watch the breath. You know, breathing in and out is happening naturally. To brighten the limita sampasadana. It's also, Abhipramojayang. Pramoja is like joy. It is, but very deep joy, confidence. And that Pramojayang, it also requires a sense of trust in that sort of object. So just let it develop. And then it gets very, very bright by itself and very beautiful. Of course, the other one of samadhang, stilling that nimitta, those two go together. The more still you make it, the more joyful it is. The more joyful it is, the easier it is to keep still. So those are just two things which happen when you get a nimitta, a light in the mind. Now, those lights in the mind can be all sorts of things. You know that many times it can be just like the screen nimitta. So your whole mind is just, you know, it's got a light to it, it's bright. It may not even be that bright, but you know, you can see that it's in a little bit of a glow there. Just don't do anything with it, just relax and let it develop by itself. The more you try to do something with it, the more you impede its progress. Or rather, ingress, rather than progress is a much better word. And sometimes you have firework nimittas. Yeah, you're getting some lights in the mind, but you're just a little bit too excited, too unstable. So just let it happen and just relax to the max. Those words are not new age. This is really deep meditation. You just let it be. Really relax. Not trying to rush it. Not being afraid of it. Just let it develop. And after a while, the fireworks, they nimittas, the flashes of light get more strong and lasting longer. And sometimes the nimittas, the lights you see in the mind, can be complicated nimittas. I call them complicated nimittas. They can be like fields and streams or mountains or statues or all sorts of stuff. But if it's a complicated nimitta, sometimes you work so hard, just enjoy it. So you don't have to say, oh, I've got to make this go better. No, just relax and have a bit of fun. So if you see something weird, great, have fun with it. So one of the nimittas I saw a long time ago when I was meditating, very clear, very real, you know, in your mind, was of a monster. Demon. Oh, sorry, I'm here. Yeah? Okay. The demon. And the demon had his big bulging eyes. Now the horns coming out of his head. And it had spiky hair. This was before the punks. It was a long time ago. Really spiky hair. And it had the mouth was actually had teeth which was all serrated, like it was all sharp, like vampire teeth, dripping red, obviously blood. And it was had a really angry scowl, and it had this necklace of skulls, shrunken skulls. And its tongue would come out. It was doing at me. I like doing that. Now, one of the things, I don't know where I get these techniques from. Just, okay, you know, you can come. And, you know, sometimes when you meditate for many, many hours, and you get a bit bored sometimes, when something like that happens, oh, that's really cool. Yeah, this is interesting. Monster, yeah, let's have some fun. Because, you know, you didn't have movies. You know, sometimes you felt you missed out in life, not seeing vampires and zombies and all sorts of stuff. But you can actually get them yourself. Yeah. Now, one thing which I recognized straight away, that I sort of knew where that one came from because I'd seen it in the temple drawing. You know, the sort of, sometimes the temple drawings are monsters. So, you know, it is just conditioned. So it wasn't a real monster. So I thought, great, let's have some fun. So first of all, his big bulging eyes, which were pretty scary, I put some sunglasses on it. like it looked like Elvis Presley. Really a cool monster. And then his hat, his head, you know, spiky hair. You know, that wasn't sort of really appropriate for a Buddhist monk, so I put a sun hat on it. You know, like a straw hat with a little flower coming out. And its mouth with the serrated teeth, like, you know, saw. Okay, like I used to do at school as a naughty school kid, sometimes you do, you black out a few teeth. So I had these big holes in his teeth, like it really needs to go to see a monster dentist quickly. And then I put a little cigarette in its mouth, you know, and then, what else did I do? Oh, that's right, its mouth. I made it smile. And that was the end of the monster. As soon as I turned, oh, you just need to think that. And it happens. Because it's a mind-created image. And as soon as the corners of its mouth turned up, that was it. I laughed. And that demon vanished and never came back again. I totally humiliated it. Imagine a monster, you know, with a straw hat and a flower. wearing rain pants. Yeah, I taught that to someone else once. There's this man who was doing some meditation. He said he started to see these monsters coming out of the paving bricks in Bodhinyana Monastery. He said, oh, wonderful. So, okay, this is what you do with them. You see how you can actually put hats on them, pipes or whatever, funny glasses like Elton John or whatever, and sort of see what happens. He had a wonderful day playing with his monsters. He wasn't at all afraid. He said, oh, really, this is an amazing, wonderful day. I really enjoyed that. Until later on in the afternoon, the monsters had enough of this guy. And so they never came back again. So, but this is actually how you work with these mind objects, these nimittas. They're created by you. And you can actually depend on how you look at them, your attitude towards them. If you're afraid, then they get power. If you play with them and have some sort of fun with them, it means that after a while they disappear. You're enjoying their company. So anyway, so that's those nimittas. But if it's like landscapes or beautiful, you can enjoy it for a little while. But one nice thing to do is actually to look for the most beautiful part of that nimitta, that scene. And so I've already given you the instruction. You don't have to even remember it now. It will happen automatically once I suggest that. It lodges in your brain, in your mind, and you find that when you're watching this scene, like one of the ones I remember seeing, this beautiful, I think I was in Thailand, and saw this beautiful green hills, beautiful little river, no mosquitoes, nice little trees in the morning, and saw little dewdrops on the end of the trees where it was sparkling. He knew straight away, just pay attention to that little twinkle on the tip of the leaf, which was a dewdrop in the morning sunshine. And of course the mind just went right into there, and that became a beautiful, simple nimitta. The most beautiful part, the most beautiful part, the most beautiful part, the most beautiful part. Let's go to the positive side. If you are a fault finder, if you develop in your life, always thinking, yeah, these cushions are too hard, these teddy bears, they're just for kids, I want the serious meditation stuff, the huts are too comfortable, we should turn off the hot water and just have cold showers in the morning. We should, you know, sometimes that people always look at the faults in life, like the two bad bricks in the wall, the mind, their eyes go straight to the faults. And if you develop the fault-finding mind, which is negativity, you'll find when it gets to meditation, always see the faults. And you'll never get into the deep meditations. You see the faults in this image, rather than allowing the mind to see the beautiful side. What they call the subha-nimitta. Subha, not with the A in front. The perception of the beautiful, the positive, the pure. And if you can do that with even people. Yeah, I know people are just a bit imperfect sometimes. Ajahn Brahm still tells stupid jokes. Every time, Angie keeps telling me off for saying the shit word. He always, Ajahn Chah used to say that. You know, in his the Thai form, the ki. And you know, people would really sort of appreciate who's speaking local language. But anyway, it's just, you know, that no one is that perfect. But those idiosyncrasies, put them aside and see something which is more beautiful. And then you can appreciate other people. Yeah, they're not perfect, they're trying their best. They're okay. And then you can start appreciating, you know, your boss at work. You may have a very difficult boss, but, you know, that if he keeps calling you stupid, you're stupid working. So, well, you hired me. Whose fault is it? But anyhow, if you have a positive mind, you can actually work with anybody. And if you develop that positive mind, oh, the food, it might not be the best in the world, but you got some food today. Wow, it's great. And the bed might be, you know, not the softest, but you can sleep on it. And the mind might not be the smartest, but it's good enough. And that idea of good enough, you see the goodness in things, you see the beauty in things, the positiveness. You know, poor old Donald Trump. You know, he may not be just the best, but he's okay. At least he's not sort of blowing people up yet. And actually, if you see the good in somebody, that's what they show you back. So when you look at nimittas, if you develop a very positive mind, when you see a nimitta, it may not be the best, but it's good enough. So this is your first little nimitta comes and visits you. You're not maybe not Ajahn Brahm says full of bliss and blinding and like looking at the sun. But that's Ajahn Brahm's nimitta. This is your nimitta. Ah, it's my little nimitta. Thank you for coming. Then that little nimitta is really going to show off what it's capable of. You see the beauty in things. You don't see its faults. You see the good side of it. And when you do that, that's called abhipramojjhanacittam. That is putting up beauty, shining up the nimitta, sometimes I call it, getting it brighter and more beautiful. And that actually shows you, if you develop a negative mind, always seeing the faults, the fault-finding mind I called it, you're going to sort of have difficulty with the nimittas. If you develop, you know, your precepts, compassion, kindness, generosity, just, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt, I don't know why they keep slamming the door. Maybe they got some sort of slamming the door fetish which they've been to psychologists about and no one can actually sort of stop it. So they're trying their best, so I give them a break. So when you give people the benefit of the doubt, you stop finding fault in them. You stop finding fault in yourself, in your partner, in your job, in your body. Then when you go into your nimitta, it's so easy to brighten it up. Well, nimitta gets really beautiful. And then when you get to the stilling the nimitta, sometimes the nimitta moves all over the place. People get some amazing nimittas just twirling around, you know, just being, you know, it's interesting, but after a while it's pretty tiring, moving around so much. You know, calm down. You say calm down to the nimitta, then it gets worse. So you learn how just to relax to the max with the nimitta. That's just like I said with Ajahn Chah, the still forest pool. Or one little technique which I found, that there was, my nimitta was pretty still for a while, but it kept on moving. I could never sort of really become still. Tried all sorts of things, but it was never, it was pretty good, but it's not really sort of totally still to sort of, to be stabilized to the next stage of meditation. Until one day, I was shaving in the mirror, and I noticed that image in the mirror was moving. And just to prove it to myself, I held the mirror perfectly still. I held the mirror, but still the image was moving. It wasn't the mirror's fault. It was like the one which was watching. I was moving. That's why the image was moving. So I realized I was trying to hold the mind still. But the nimitta kept on moving. So I imagined the one who was watching. I kept that still. And then the nimitta became still. It was just a perception, a way of looking, how to still the nimitta when you are still, the one which is watching. I don't mean a self, it's just a way of looking. Then the nimitta becomes still. And once it becomes still, then it really takes off. What does it take off? It's the Rinpocheyang Chittang. And the Rinpocheyang Chittang, it's this, it's code if people know Pali, for it means freeing the mind, but the freedoms are the similes for the words for the jhanas. That's where you, the nimitta is so still, so powerful, then you enter that nimitta, it just sucks you in, or you get enveloped by it, and then you're in a jhana. Tomorrow I'll talk more about the jhanas on Samma Samadhi, exactly what they are. So, that becomes the third Satipatthana. The jitta, you're really getting to know what this jitta is. Collecting data. Real big powerful data, so eventually you can work out what is this body and mind. And then, the last four factors of the Anapanasati, when you learn to explore the impermanence in breath meditation, exploring it, not contemplating it, contemplating is gross. Explorations, allowing the mind to wander in here and go to avenues you've never been to before, even if it's without names. You explore the impermanence in breath meditation, especially the fact that lots of stuff disappear. Explore things fading away. Explore things ceasing in breath meditation. When you learn to explore relinquishing things in breath meditation. Just like remember the simile of the tadpole again. The tadpole, she saw when she became a frog, impermanence, that these things, now they're here, now they're gone. Impermanence doesn't mean just going down to the lake and just seeing the waves on the lake. It's much more radical than that. Sometimes you go sitting by the lake and then the whole lake vanishes. It's just not there anymore. Just like that wall in that Zen monastery I talked about. There's no lake. There's no earth. There's no sky. A whole lot vanishes. That's weird. That's impermanence. And that went, phew, what's going on here? I'm not crazy. But things faded and ceased. And relinquishing. On these occasions you are mindful of mind objects, the powerful ones, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. Oh, actually, I didn't finish off the nimitta thing. I do not say that there's a development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull. is not fully aware. Because to get fully aware, that's the job of the jhanas. The jhanas actually totally banish the five hindrances for a long period of time. And you don't know what the superpower mindfulness, which happens in jhanas and afterwards. So anyway, so going back to number four. On these occasions, you are mindful of mind objects, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, having seen with wisdom the impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment of the five hindrances, you are mindful with equanimity. That is why on that occasion, you are mindfulness of mind objects, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. Then that is how mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated completes the four focuses of mindfulness. So you don't just turn to vipassana. Anapanasati is vipassana. Vipassana is anapanasati. So you get the four focuses of mindfulness, now the next thing, complete the seven enlightenment factors. How do the four focuses of mindfulness developed and cultivated to complete the seven enlightenment factors? They're called enlightenment factors because there's almost like the path to develop to enlightenment, and they describe some of the experiences of enlightenment. When you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, on that occasion, steady mindfulness is established in you. On whatever occasion, steady mindfulness is established in you, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. So you have some mindfulness there, but it needs to be developed to get very, very powerful and penetrating. When you are thus mindful, you explore the Dhamma with wisdom. On whatever occasion, abiding thus mindful, you explore the Dhamma. Remember what I said, it's about where things come from, the why. On that occasion, the exploration of Dhamma enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment in you. When you explore Dhamma with wisdom and embark upon it, a full inquiry into it, unflagging energy is aroused. On whatever occasion, unflagging energy is aroused, and you explore the Dhamma with wisdom, on that occasion, the enlightenment, energy enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by developing it comes to fulfillment in you. Now, I did actually mention earlier that the word here, virya, you know, it's connected to the word like heroic energy. Heroic commitment. You may know that the leader of the Jains, who was lived at the same time as the Buddhas, and it's quite a strange coincidence, but his name was Mahavira, the great hero. So Vira was not just by energy, but heroic self-sacrificing commitment. And that gives you another little angle on what this is. Because you have the mindful and you are exploring the Dhamma, there's a lot of letting go there. And when you have aroused energy, the unworldly joy, pity, not the joy of attaining something or getting somewhere, but the just natural joy, selfless happiness. On whatever occasion unworldly joy arises, on that occasion the joy enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in you. That's piti. When you experience unworldly joy, your body and mind become tranquil. On whatever occasion the body and the mind become tranquil and you experience joy, on that occasion the tranquility enlightenment factor is pasati, aroused in you. You develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in you. So see, even just already, you know that we have even enlightenment factors, just a focus on joy. It's not just hard, don't smile. The joy happens. And it's supposed to happen. It's unworldly joy. And the joy is what causes the tranquility of the body. You can actually sit still. Sometimes you can sit perfectly still, you're having a great time, no force at all. And this is actually how you can sit for hours, having a great time. That's physical stillness. You also have the mental tranquility. You're satisfied with the joy. So you don't want to seek for anything. you got enough. And when your body, another pleasure, when your body is tranquil, you feel pleasure in the mind. And then the mind becomes still. This is a very important, so important I don't mind keep repeating this in Pali. Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati. It's from this happiness that the mind becomes still. The mind enters jhana through happiness, not through pain, not through struggle, but just so happy. Then you feel pleasure in the mind, and then the mind becomes still. On whatever occasion the mind becomes still and joyful, on that occasion the stillness, samadhi, enlightenment factors is aroused in you, and you develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in you. And you observe such a still mind with equanimity. On whatever occasion you observe the equanimity, with equanimity, the still mind, on that occasion the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by development it comes fulfillment in you. That is how the four focuses of mindfulness developed and cultivated complete the seven enlightenment factors. And so it just sums up. So here you develop the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, physical and mental. So, you know, you've got your eyes closed or you're in a quiet place, and it's also your mind is secluded from the body, from past and future, from thinking. It's secluded from all those worries. It's like you have gone away into a peaceful place, a cave, up in the mountains somewhere. You're apart from things, and especially secluded even from the five senses and the body. Which is supported by seclusion, fading away and cessation, allowing things to go, and ripens in relinquishing things. Why do I have to keep carrying this stuff? You develop the exploration of Dharma enlightenment factor, the energy, the joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity enlightenment factor, all of which is supported by seclusion, fading away and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. That is how the seven enlightenment factors, developed and cultivated, complete true knowledge and deliverance, otherwise called for full enlightenment. So here we have Anapanasati Sutta as a complete path all in itself. And you have Satipatthana as a complete path all in itself, because they overlap. Each one of these, you can focus on just one thing, but you have to do all the other things as well. In Satipatthana, you have to have restrained the five hindrances, which means you practice your precepts, you've done virtue, that you've got the right view, you have the right motivation, the second factor. Can we go to the second factor because of the Eightfold Path? Because that is important, that actually is part of all these other things which I've been talking about, like Satipatthana. It's right motivation. Sometimes.
Can you explain learn to explore the impermanence in breath meditation? Does it come automatically?
Yes. So you've had the experience, you've got the data. Now you explore what that data means. So imagine you're the frog. So, this is weird. You've got some data which is very, very hard to gain, and this is very exceptional data. You explore. Why is this so different? Crouching on the dry land. You don't know it's dry land, you're crouching on this. What is missing? What is different, from what's happened before? In particular, what has faded away and ceased? What is not there? Sometimes people explore by saying, what is there? What remains? But here we're exploring what has ceased, what has disappeared. What is not there? Like in Jhana Grove. What don't you have in Jhana Grove? What's missing that causes some peace and happiness? Schedules? Bosses? TV? Compulsion? Having to do stuff? What is not here? Traffic? Family? And all the problems, difficulties. So why is Jhana Grove happy? Why do people like to come here? Don't look for what's here. Instead, look for what's missing. The suffering which you take for granted is not here. And that is one of the reasons why it's happiness. When your body vanishes, why is that so much bliss? Why did that BBC lady just, I don't want to go back to this body, sorry, no. And it's because, only when it's missing, when your body really goes, then you realize what a heavy burden and affliction it is having a body. I'm never comfortable, you always got to scratch something, too hot, too cold, you've got to blow your nose, you've got to go to the toilet, you've got to have a cup of tea. Just have a look around how people are moving. Someone is scratching their chin, someone has moved their head up, somebody is just supporting their chin, somebody has just wiped their nose, somebody has moved their foot up, somebody has moved their hair. You do this automatically. You don't even think about it. But can you be absolutely still? That takes effort, doesn't it? And you've got to move something. Because this body is actually very demanding. It's never really comfortable. Even when you go to sleep, you've got to toss and turn. So when you actually notice that, this body is a burden. We've got used to it. But after a while, when the body vanishes, wow, free, woo! That's when you realize that what's missing was suffering. That's why it's happy. So this is actually where the impermanence in these things, or the explore it, is that just the lake has gone. The reason why impermanence, because the word is anicca, you all know. Its opposite is nitya. And nitya means dependable, regular, certain. And that is actually what comes up when, as I said, if you really want to learn Pali, learn it from the Vinaya, from the stories, which ground these words in real life. And this happens here today. For example, the Thai lady Al, she's been bringing food every Thursday. Thursday's her day. And she always brings food. I don't know, for about 30 years she's bringing food to the monks every Thursday. And it's what we call regular food. I know, unless she's very sick, that she'll bring food next Thursday as well for the monks. And so that's what we call regular, dependable. That's nitya. The opposite of anicca, impermanence, is when things which are always there, things you can rely upon, suddenly aren't there anymore. Things which you even didn't notice. Sometimes people have been married for years and years, 50 years, and then their partner dies. And that's really a shock. They know people are going to die, but something which is always there, there's a big hole in their house. There's just something missing in their life. Because they've got used to it. That is impermanence. It's not just rise and fall, it's much more powerful than that. And when that happens, you explore it. Why? And then you get this wonderful insights that this, now you see what was there, which you take for granted, which you don't see. When it's taken away from you, now you know what it is. And you get some understanding of fading away and ceasing. But anyway, with right motivation, on number two, I've got it on page 34. The second factor of the Eightfold Path. Because sometimes people call it right thought, right intention. But if there are any lawyers in here, you know that intention is the act looking towards what it wanted to achieve, where it wanted to go. What did you aim to get by doing that or saying that? But what this is not where your actions of body, speech or mind are going to, it's where it's coming from. It's called motivation. And actions of body, speech or mind arising from a motive of renunciation, otherwise called letting go. You got it yet? Letting go, arising from a motive of kindness, arising from a motive of gentleness, this is called right motivation. And the reason I emphasize that is because sometimes I look to the Eightfold, where the heck is compassion and kindness? You know, you don't have right compassion. In there you've got, you know, right view, right motivation, right speech, action, livelihood, right, sometimes people call it efforts, mindfulness and concentration or stillness, I prefer, is the kindness. And then afterwards, and here it is, it's the second or the third part of right motivation. It's arising from motivation of renunciation, which is letting go, kindness and gentleness. Instead of calling it renunciation, I sometimes call it making peace. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. So that's, you know, where we're coming from when we practice the Eightfold Path. Letting go, not getting things. Ajahn Chah used to say we meditate not to attain things, but to let things go. To have less, not more. Not to have attainments and go back. On Ajahn Brahm's retreat, what did you get? Did you get unlimited nothing? I got limited. I got first jhana. First jhana, come on. I got second jhana this time. Second jhana, oh no, no. I got stream winning this time. Whoa. And it becomes what we call spiritual materialism. So spiritual one-upmanship. Na, 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 na. I'm higher than you are. I'm more attained than you are. Bah, 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 bah. It's just, you know what happens in the office. This is not the office. So we're not to attain things, but to let go of things. So this is where we, kindness, gentleness, and letting go. And that is number two. That comes from right view. Once you understand what the right view is, what we're in this for, experiencing non-self, it's not to get things, not to make a stronger sense of self, but to actually to let go and be kind, be gentle. And then from that, the right speech, action, livelihood become automatic. It's not about proving something to others or getting other people out of the way for your practice. And kindness and gentleness. And that comes out of body in speech, action and livelihood. And that is restraining a lot of the defilements, which is well part of the sixth factor, the right effort, I call it right right endeavor. And then from that is what restrains the hindrances. So when you go into mindfulness, it's so easy. And that creates a lot of stillness, so that you get jhanas. And the jhanas get you enlightened. Yeah. Oh, well. If you had right view to begin with, then you wouldn't really need to practice. You'd already be enlightened. So, you know, everyone, when you go to school, you know, you're expected to not know maths. So that's why they teach you maths. Otherwise, the teacher would have no job to do. So you have wrong view in that sense. So that's why sometimes it's a little bit difficult. When you've got sort of, you know, ideas in the world, you have to get married, you know, you have to have sex to have some fun, you have to have financial security, you know, you have to keep healthy by exercising and eating the right food. You have all these ideas, and then sometimes they get challenged in life, you know, and sometimes what's going on. And then sometimes that some of these right views, You actually see another way of looking at things. And at first it becomes intriguing. Sort of makes sense. And of course then you develop it more and it makes even more sense. Yeah, because, you know, for your example, just coming here with making effort, and then you come here and I say, ah, oh, relax to the max. You haven't heard that one before. I think, well, what are you talking about? You know, this can't be Buddhism. You've got to strive. You know, no pain, no gain. So, you know, that's just the problem there. But then you hear something else and you give it a try. And then, wow, it works. So anyway, there we go. That is, I've gone over time again. But it doesn't matter because I didn't miss the class yesterday. So that is the Satipatthana through Anapanasati. It all comes together. And tomorrow, the jhanas. Wow. The really juicy stuff. Anyway, it's good to know these things, and don't think you can't do them. You have the jhanas right now, they're just right inside us. Allow the little lotus to open up. Sadhu! 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 Very good. And I know that, did Claire get her robe she wanted to offer? Marlene? No, Claire's got, I think she's already left to go. She's at back.
No,
Nicholas? Yeah, Nicholas, yeah. So, if, this
is, tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning. Going back tomorrow. Oh, tomorrow night, no problem at all. So anyway, so we brought a couple of robes over if people want to do robe offering, because that's one of the things for the Katina ceremony, you offer robes and stuff, and some of you won't be here. So we've got some robes over there. Okay, Friday night, okay. Yeah. So anyway, we've got some, we've got lots more. Anyway, we'll recycle them, eh? Yeah. Well, if you need to go early, you can always do that in your time. Yeah, whenever. So can do, yeah. So we've only got 4 hours. Maybe bring some more over later on. Recycle, yeah. So what we used to do, you offer it, and it goes into the room, and it goes round again. You know, we used to do that, you know, obviously don't do that with the freeing the animals. But it came the custom over in Australia that on funerals, they'd have these white pigeons, and at the funeral ceremony, they let the pigeons fly off, and it was like, almost like imagining freeing the soul of the departed so they can fly. It was a wonderful imagery, you know, for people when they're letting go their loved ones. And of course, the birds always fly up to the heavens. So the imagery was very good for Westerners. But they always used to have white doves, a symbol of purity. But of course, you know, the white doves, you know, you can't find doves that easily. They're well trained. They're homing pigeons, and they always go back to the funeral parlour afterwards, where they have a nice, safe home, and they get well fed with water. So it's just their job. They're very happy to do that. So they spend the night in the funeral parlour, and then they get taken to the cemetery or whatever, and then they get released, they fly back to the funeral parlour. But then, you know what happened once? We did one funeral over in Nonamoa, and we let the birds fly off. But one of them, I've had enough of this, I'm staying at the temple. And the white dove stayed for, maybe 6 or 7 months at the temple. Very smart dove. Of course, it got really well fed by everybody. And so they had their choice. Okay, I've done with work, all this flying around. So they stayed put in the temple. A very beautiful little bird. So anyway, that's, you know, sometimes it's is it okay to feed those animals? If they have a nice home, fine. So that's with the robes as well. They just, that's their job to get this. At least we're honest about it. Okay, very good. Doesn't go to waste, yeah. And as also, whatever donation you want to give, even the lowest donation is 10 cents. What's the lowest coin in Singapore?
$1. Oh, lowest coin,
5
cents.
5 cents, okay, 5 cents. Why not? We can recycle the coins as well. Okay, whatever. I didn't do the hee hee hee. Okay. I did the side already. Yeah. But I did do the hee. Okay, do it again. Come on. Recycle it.